price is lower. This seemingly paradoxical situation has to be understood in terms of its purpose, namely to allow the producers to practice price discrimination by screening. IBM offered two versions of its laser printer. The E version printed at 5 pages per minute, while for $200 more, you could get the fast version that printed at 10 pages per minute. The only difference between the two was that IBM added a chip in the firmware of the E version that added some wait states to slow down the printing. If they hadn't done this, then they would have had to sell all their printers at one price. But with the slowed-down version, they could offer a lower price to home users who were willing to wait longer for their printouts. The Sharp DVE-611 DVD player and their DV-740U unit were both made in the same Shanghai plant. The key difference was that the DVE-611 lacked the ability to play DVDs formatted to the European standard, called PAL, on television sets that use the American standard, called NTSC. However, it turns out that the functionality was there all along, just hidden from the customer. Sharp had shaved down the system switch button and then covered it with the remote control faceplate. There were some ingenious users who figured this out and shared their discovery on the web. You could restore full functionality simply by punching a hole in the faceplate at the appropriate spot. Companies often go through great effort to create damaged versions of their goods, and customers often go to great lengths to restore the product. Airline pricing is probably the example of price discrimination most familiar to readers, so we develop it a little further to give you an idea of the quantitative aspects of designing such a scheme. For this purpose, we introduce Pie in the Sky, PITS, an airline running a service from Podunk to South Succotash. It carries some business passengers and some tourists. The former type is willing to pay a higher price than the latter. To serve the tourists profitably without giving the same low price to the business travelers, PITS has to develop a way of creating different versions of the same flight and price the versions in such a way that each type will choose a different version. First class and economy class might be one way to do this, and we will take that as our example. Another common distinction is that between unrestricted and restricted fares. Suppose that 30% of the customers are business people and 70% are tourists. We will do the calculation on the basis of per 100 customers. The table shows the maximum price each type is willing to pay for each class of service, technically referred to as the reservation price, and the costs of providing the two types of service. PITS cost for economy service is $100. The reservation price for tourist is $140. The reservation price for business people, $225. PITS potential profit for tourists is $40. PITS potential profit for business people is $125. PITS cost for first class service is $150. The reservation price for tourist is $175. The reservation price for business people is $300. PITS potential profit for tourist is $25. PITS potential profit for business people is $150. Begin by setting up a situation that is ideal from PITS' point of view. Suppose it knows the type of each customer, for example, by observing their dress as they come to make their reservations. Also suppose that there are no legal prohibitions or resale possibilities. Then PITS can practice what is called perfect price discrimination. To each business person, it could sell a first-class ticket at $300 for a profit of $300 minus $150 equals $150, or an economy ticket at $225 for a profit of $225 minus $100 equals $125. The former is better for PITS. To each tourist, it could sell a first-class ticket at $175 for a profit of $175 minus $150 equals $25. Or an economy ticket at $140 for a profit of $140 minus $100 equals $40. The latter is better for Pitts. Ideally, Pitts would like to sell only first-class tickets to business travelers and only economy-class tickets to tourists, in each case at a price equal to the maximum willingness to pay. Pitts' total profit per 100 customers from this strategy will be 140 minus 100 times 70 plus 300 minus 150 times 30 equals 40 times 70 plus 150 times 30 equals 2,800 plus 4,500 equals 7,300. Now turn to the more realistic scenario where Pitts cannot identify the type of each customer or is not allowed to use the information for purposes of overt discrimination. How can it use the versions to screen the customers? Most importantly, it cannot charge the business travelers their full willingness to pay for first-class seats. They could buy economy-class seats for $140 when they are willing to pay $225. Doing so would give them an extra benefit, or consumer surplus in the jargon of economics, of $85. They might use it, for example, for better food or accommodation on their trip. Paying the maximum $300 that they are willing to pay for a first-class seat would give them no consumer surplus. Therefore, they would switch to economy class and screening would fail. The maximum that Pitts can charge for first class must give business travelers at least as much extra benefit as the $85 they can get if they buy an economy class ticket, so the price of first class tickets can be at most $300 minus $85 equals $215. Perhaps it should be $214 to create a definite positive reason for business travelers to choose first class. But we will ignore the trivial difference. Pitt's profit will be 140 minus 100 times 70 plus 215 minus 150 times 30 equals 40 times 70 plus 65 times 30 equals 2,800 plus 1,950 equals 4,750. So, as we see, Pitts can successfully screen and separate the two types of travelers based on their self-selection of the two types of services. But Pitts must sacrifice some profit to achieve this indirect discrimination. It must charge the business travelers less than their full willingness to pay. As a result, Pitts' profit per 100 passengers drops from the $7,300 it could achieve if it could discriminate overtly with direct knowledge of each customer's type to the $4,750 it achieves from the indirect discrimination based on self-selection. The difference, $2,550, is precisely 85 times 30. Where 85 is the drop in the first class fare below the business traveler's full willingness to pay for this service, and 30 is the number of business travelers. Pitts has to keep the first class fare sufficiently low to give the business travelers enough incentive to choose this service and not defect to making the choice that Pitts intends for the tourists. Such a requirement or constraint on the screener's strategy is called an incentive compatibility constraint. The only way Pitts could charge more than $215 to business travelers without inducing their defection would be to increase the economy class fare. For example, if the first class fare is $240 and the economy class fare is $165, then business travelers get equal extra benefit, consumer surplus, from the two classes. $300 minus $240 from first class and $225 minus $165 from economy class, or $60 from each. So they are only just willing to buy first class tickets. But at $140, the economy class fare is already at the limit of the tourist's willingness to pay. If Pitts raised it to even $141, it would lose these customers altogether. This requirement, namely that the customer type in question remains willing to buy, is called that type's participation constraint. Pitts' pricing strategy is thus squeezed between the participation constraint of the tourists and the incentive compatibility constraint of the business people. In this situation, the screening strategy above charges $215 for first class and $140 for economy class, is in fact the most profitable for Pitts. It takes a little mathematics to prove that rigorously, so we merely assert it. Whether this strategy is optimal for Pitts depends on the specific numbers in the example. Suppose the proportion of business travelers were much higher, say 50%, then the sacrifice of $85 on each business traveler may be too high to justify keeping the few tourists. Pitts may do better not to serve them at all, that is, violate their participation constraint and raise the price of first-class service for the business travelers. Indeed, the strategy of discrimination by screening with these numbers of travelers yields 140 minus 100 times 50 plus 215 minus 150 times 50 equals 40 times 50 plus 65 times 50 equals 2,000 plus 3,250 equals 5,250. While the strategy of serving only business travelers in first class at $300 would yield 300 minus 150 times 50 equals 150 times 50 equals 7,500. If there are only a few customers with low willingness to pay, the seller might find it better not to serve them at all than to offer sufficiently low prices to the mass of high-paying customers to prevent their switching to the low-priced version. Now that you know what to look for, you will see screening for price discrimination everywhere. And if you look in the research literature, you will see analyses of strategies for screening by self-selection equally frequently. Some of these strategies are quite complicated, and the theories need a lot of mathematics. But the basic idea driving all these instances is the interplay between the twin requirements of incentive compatibility and participation. Trip to the gym number 5. There is also a participation constraint for business travelers and an incentive compatibility constraint for the tourists. Check that these are automatically satisfied at the stated prices. Case study. Going undercover. Another friend of ours, Tanya, is an anthropologist. While most anthropologists travel to the ends of the earth to study some unusual tribe, Tanya did her fieldwork in London. Her subject was witches. Yes, witches. Even in modern-day London, there are still a surprisingly large number of people who gather together to trade spells and study witchcraft. Not that being a modern witch is easy. It requires a certain amount of rationalization to be a witch riding the tube. Often anthropologists have trouble gaining their subjects' confidence, but Tanya's group was especially welcoming. When she told them she was an anthropologist, they saw this as a clever ruse. She was really a witch with a great cover story. One of the unusual features of the witches' meetings is that they took place in the nude. Why might that be? Case discussion. Any outsider group has to worry that its members will be observers rather than participants. Are you sitting there making fun of the whole process, or are you being a part of it? If you are sitting there in the nude, it is pretty hard to say that you are just watching and making fun of the others. You are well into it. Thus, the nudity is a credible screening device. If you truly believe in the coven, then it is relatively costless to be there in the nude. But if you are a skeptic, then being there in the nude is hard to explain, both to others and to yourself. For the same reason, gang initiation rites often involve taking actions that are relatively cheap if you are truly interested in gang life, tattoos, committing crimes, but quite costly if you are an undercover cop trying to infiltrate the gang. For more cases on interpreting and manipulating information, see The Other Person's Envelope is Always Greener. But One Life to Lay Down for Your Country, King Solomon's Dilemma Redux, and The King Lear Problem in Chapter 14. Chapter 9. Cooperation and Coordination. For Whom the Bell Curve Tolls. In the 1950s, the Ivy League colleges were faced with a problem. Each school wanted to produce a winning football team. The colleges found themselves overemphasizing athletics and compromising their academic standards in order to build a championship team. Yet no matter how often they practiced or how much money they spent, at the end of the season, the standings were much as they had been before. The average win-loss record was still 50-50. The inescapable mathematical fact is that for every winner, there had to be a loser. All the extra work canceled itself out. The excitement of college sports depends as much on the closeness and intensity of the competition as on the level of skill. Many fans prefer college basketball and football to the professional versions. While the level of skill is lower, there is often more excitement and intensity to the competition. With this idea in mind, the colleges got smart. They joined together and agreed to limit spring training to one day. Although there were more fumbles, the games were no less exciting. Athletes had more time to concentrate on their studies. Everyone was better off, except some alumni who wanted their alma maters to excel at football and forget about academic work. Many students would like to have a similar agreement with their fellow students before examinations. When grades are based on a traditional bell curve, one's relative standing in the class matters more than the absolute level of one's knowledge. It matters not how much you know, only that others know less than you. The way to gain an advantage over the other students is to study more. If they all do so, they all have more knowledge. But the relative standings, and therefore the bottom line, the grades, are largely unchanged. If only everyone in the class could agree to limit spring studying to one, preferably rainy, day, they would get the same grades with less effort. The feature common to these situations is that success is determined by relative rather than absolute performance. When one participant improves his own ranking, he necessarily worsens everyone else's ranking. But the fact that one's victory requires someone else's defeat does not make the game zero-sum. In a zero-sum game, it is not possible to make everyone better off. Here it is. The scope for gain comes from reducing the inputs. While there might always be the same number of winners and losers, it can be less costly for everyone to play the game. The source of the problem of why some students study too much is that they do not have to pay a price or compensation to the others. Each student's studying is akin to a factory's polluting. It makes it more difficult for all the other students to breathe. Because there is no market for buying and selling studying time, the result is a rat race. Each participant strives too hard, with too little to show for his efforts. But no one team or student is willing to be the only one or the leader in reducing the effort. This is just like a prisoner's dilemma with more than two prisoners. An escape from the horns of this dilemma requires an enforceable collective agreement. As with the Ivy League or OPEC, the trick is to form a cartel to limit competition. The problem for high school students is that the cartel cannot easily detect cheating. For the collectivity of students, a cheater is one who studies more to sneak an advantage over the others. It is hard to tell if some are secretly studying until after they have aced the test. By then, it is too late. In some small towns, high school students do have a way to enforce no studying cartels. Everyone gets together and cruises Main Street at night. The absence of those home studying is noticed. Punishment can be social ostracism or worse. To arrange a self-enforcing cartel is difficult. It is all the better if an outsider enforces the collective agreement limiting competition. This is just what happened for cigarette advertising, although not intentionally. In the old days, cigarette companies used to spend money to convince consumers to walk a mile for their product, or to fight rather than switch. The different campaigns made advertising agencies rich, but their main purpose was defensive. Each company advertised because the others did too. Then, in 1968, cigarette advertisements were banned from TV by law. The companies thought this restriction would hurt them and fought against it. But when the smoke cleared, they saw that the ban helped them all avoid costly advertising campaigns and thus improved all their profits. The route less traveled. There are two main ways to commute from Berkeley to San Francisco. One is driving over the Bay Bridge, and the other is taking public transportation, the Bay Area Rapid Transit Train, BART. Crossing the bridge is the shortest route, and with no traffic, a car can make the trip in 20 minutes. But that is rarely the case. The bridge has only four lanes and is easily congested. We suppose that each additional 2,000 cars per hour causes a 10-minute delay for everyone on the road. For example, with 2,000 cars, the travel time rises to 30 minutes. At 4,000 cars, to 40 minutes. The BART train makes a number of stops, and one has to walk to the station and wait for the train. It is fair to say that the trip takes closer to 40 minutes along this route, but the train never fights traffic. When train usage rises, they put on more cars, and the commuting time stays roughly constant. If, during rush hour, 10,000 commuters want to go from Berkeley to San Francisco, how will the commuters be distributed over the two routes? Each commuter will act selfishly, choosing the route that minimizes his own transportation time. Left to their own devices, 40% will drive and 60% will take the train. The commuting time will be 40 minutes for everyone. This outcome is the equilibrium of a game. We can see this result by asking what would happen if the split were different. Suppose only 2,000 drivers took the Bay Bridge. With less congestion, the trip would take less time, 30 minutes, along this route. Then, some of the 8,000 BART commuters would find out that they could save time by switching and would do so. Conversely, if there were, say, 8,000 drivers using the Bay Bridge, each spending 60 minutes, some of them would switch to the train for the faster trip it provides. But when there are 4,000 drivers on the Bay Bridge and 6,000 on the train, no one can gain by switching. The commuters have reached an equilibrium. We can show the equilibrium using a simple chart, which is quite similar in spirit to the one in Chapter 3 describing the classroom experiment of the prisoner's dilemma. In this chart, we are holding the total number of commuters constant at 10,000, so that when there are 2,000 cars using the bridge, it implies that 8,000 commuters are using BART. The rising line shows how the trip time on the Bay Bridge increases as the number of drivers on it increases. The flat line shows the constant time of 40 minutes for the train. The lines intersect at E, showing that the trip times on the two routes are equal when the number of drivers on the Bay Bridge is 4,000. This graphic depiction is a useful tool to describe the equilibrium, and we will use it often in this chapter. Is this equilibrium good for the commuters as a whole? Not really. It is easy to find a better pattern. Suppose only 2,000 take the Bay Bridge. Each of them saves 10 minutes. The 2,000 who switch to the train are still spending the same time as they did before, namely 40 minutes. So are the 6,000 who were already taking the train. We have just saved 20,000 person minutes, or almost 2 weeks, from the total travel time. Why is this saving possible? Or, in other words, why were the drivers left to themselves, not guided by an invisible hand to the best mix of routes? The answer, again, lies in the cost that each user of the Bay Bridge inflicts on the others. When an extra driver takes this road, the travel time of all the other users goes up by a little bit. But the newcomer is not required to pay a price that reflects this cost. He takes into account only his own travel time. What traffic pattern is best for the group of drivers as a whole? In fact, the one we constructed, with 2,000 cars on the Bay Bridge and a total time saving of 20,000 minutes, is best. To see this, try a couple of others. If there are 3,000 cars on the Bay Bridge, the travel time is 35 minutes, with a saving of 5 minutes each, or 15,000 minutes in all. With only 1,000 cars, the travel time is 25 minutes, and each saves 15 minutes, but the total saving is again only 15,000 minutes. The intermediate point, with 2,000 drivers, each saving 10 minutes, is best. How can the best pattern be achieved? Devotees of central planning will think of issuing 2,000 licenses to use the Bay Bridge. If they are worried about the inequity of allowing those with licenses to travel in 30 minutes while the other 8,000 must take the train and spend 40 minutes, they will devise an ingenious system of rotating the licenses among the population every month. A market-based solution charges people for the harm they cause to others. Suppose each person values an hour of time at $12. That is, each would be willing to pay $12 to save an hour. Then charge a toll for driving on the Bay Bridge. Set the toll $2 above the BART fare. By our supposition, people regard an extra $2 cost as equivalent to 10 minutes of time. Now the equilibrium commuting pattern will have 2,000 cars on the Bay Bridge and 8,000 riders on BART. Each user of the Bay Bridge spends 30 minutes plus an extra $2 in commuting costs. Each BART rider spends 40 minutes. The total effective costs are the same, and no one wants to switch to the other route. In the process, we have collected $4,000 of toll revenue, plus an additional 2,000 BART fares, which can then go into the county's budget, thus benefiting everyone because taxes can be lower than they would otherwise be. A solution even closer to the spirit of free enterprise would be to allow private ownership of the Bay Bridge. The owner realizes that people are willing to pay for the advantage of a faster trip on a less congested road. He charges a price, therefore, for the privilege. How can he maximize his revenue? By maximizing the total value of the time saved, of course. The invisible hand guides people to an optimal commuting pattern only when the good commuting time is priced. With the profit-maximizing toll on the bridge, time really is money. Those commuters who ride BART are selling time to those who use the bridge. Finally, we recognize that the cost of collecting the toll sometimes exceeds the resulting benefit of saving people's time. Creating a marketplace is not a free lunch. The toll booths may be a primary cause of the congestion. If so, it may be best to tolerate the original inefficient route choices. Catch 22. Chapter 4 offered the first examples of games with many equilibria. Where should two strangers meet in New York City, Times Square or the Empire State Building? Who should return a disconnected phone call? In those examples, it was not important which of the conventions was chosen, so long as everyone agreed on the same convention. But sometimes one convention is much better than another. Even so, that doesn't mean it will always get adopted. If one convention has become established and then some change in circumstances makes another one more desirable, it can be especially hard to bring about the change. The keyboard design on most typewriters is a case in point. In the late 1800s, there was no standard pattern for the arrangement of letters on the typewriter keyboard. Then, in 1873, Christopher Sholes helped design a new improved layout. The layout became known as QWERTY, after the letter arrangement of the first six letters in the top row. QWERTY was chosen to maximize the distance between the most frequently used letters. This was a good solution in its day. It deliberately slowed down the typist and reduced the jamming of keys on manual typewriters. By 1904, the Remington Sewing Machine Company of New York was mass-producing typewriters with this layout, and it became the de facto industry standard. But with the advent of electric typewriters and later computers, this jamming problem became irrelevant. Engineers developed new keyboard layouts, such as DSK, Dvorak's Simplified Keyboard, which reduced the distance typists' fingers traveled by over 50%. The same material can be typed in 5 to 10% less time using DSK than QWERTY. But QWERTY is the established system. Almost all keyboards use it, so we all learn it and are reluctant to learn a second layout. Keyboard manufacturers continue, therefore, with QWERTY. The vicious circle is complete. If history had worked differently, and if the DSK standard had been adopted from the outset, that would have been better for today's technology. However, given where we are, the question of whether or not we should switch standards involves further considerations. There is a lot of inertia in the form of machines, keyboards, and trained typists behind QWERTY. Is it worthwhile to retool? From the point of view of society as a whole, the answer would seem to be yes. During the Second World War, the U.S. Navy used DSK typewriters on a large scale and retrained typists to use them. It found that the cost of retraining could be fully recouped in only 10 days of use. However, this study and the overall advantage of DSK has been called into question by Professors Stan Liebowitz and Stephen Margolis. It appears that an interested party, one Lieutenant Commander August Dvorak, was involved in conducting the original study. A 1956 General Services Administration study found that it took a month of 4-hour-a-day training for typists to catch up to their old QWERTY speed. At that point, further training on the Dvorak keyboard was less effective than providing training to QWERTY typists. To the extent that DSK is superior, the biggest gain is when typists learn this system from the start. If the typist becomes so good that he or she almost never has to look at the keyboard, then learning DSK makes sense. With today's software, it is a relatively simple matter to reassign the keys from one layout to another. On a Mac, it is a simple switch on the keyboard menu. Thus, the keyboard layout almost doesn't matter. Almost. The problem is, how does one learn to touch type on a mislabeled keyboard? Anyone who wants to reassign the layout from QWERTY to DSK, but cannot yet touch type, must look at the keyboard and mentally convert each key to its DSK value. This is not practical. Therefore, beginners have to learn QWERTY anyway, and that greatly reduces the gains from also learning DSK. No individual user can change the social convention. The uncoordinated decisions of individuals keep us tied to QWERTY. The problem is called a bandwagon effect, and can be illustrated using the following chart. On the horizontal axis, we show the fraction of typists using QWERTY. The vertical axis details the chance that a new typist will learn QWERTY as opposed to DSK. As drawn, if 85% of typists are using QWERTY, then the chances are 95% that a new typist will choose to learn QWERTY and only 5% that the new typist will learn DSK. The way the curve is drawn is meant to emphasize the superiority of the DSK layout. A majority of new typists will learn DSK rather than QWERTY, provided that QWERTY has anything less than a 70% market share. In spite of this handicap, it is possible for QWERTY to dominate in equilibrium. Indeed, this possibility is just what has happened in the prevailing equilibrium. The choice of which keyboard to use is a strategy. When the fraction using each technology is constant over time, we are at an equilibrium of the game. Showing that this game converges to an equilibrium is not easy. The random choice of each new typist is constantly disrupting the system. Recent high-powered mathematical tools in the field of stochastic approximation theory have allowed economists and statisticians to prove that this dynamic game does converge to an equilibrium. We now describe the possible outcomes. If the fraction of typists using QWERTY exceeds 72%, there is the expectation that an even greater fraction of people will learn QWERTY. The prevalence of QWERTY expands until it reaches 98%. At that point, the fraction of new typists learning QWERTY just equals its predominance in the population, 98%. And so there is no more upward pressure. If the number of typists using QWERTY is above 98%, the number is expected to fall back to 98%. There will always be a small number, somewhere up to 2%, of new typists who will choose to learn DSK because they are interested in the superior technology and are not concerned with the compatibility issue. Conversely, if the fraction of typists using QWERTY falls below 72%, then there is the expectation that DSK will take over. Fewer than 72% of the new typists learn QWERTY, and the subsequent fall in its usage gives new typists an even greater incentive to learn the superior layout of DSK. Once all typists are using DSK, there is no reason for a new typist to learn QWERTY, and QWERTY will die out. The mathematics says only that we will end up at one of these two possible outcomes. Everyone using DSK or 98% using QWERTY. It does not say which will occur. If we were starting from scratch, the odds are in favor of DSK being the predominant keyboard layout. But we are not. History matters. The historical accident that led to QWERTY capturing nearly 100% of typists ends up being self-perpetuating, even though the original motivation for QWERTY is long since obsolete. Since bad luck or the convergence to an inferior equilibrium is self-perpetuating, there is the possibility of making everyone better off, but it requires coordinated action. If the major computer manufacturers coordinate on a new keyboard layout, or a major employer, such as the federal government, trains its employees on a new keyboard, this could switch the equilibrium all the way from one extreme to the other. The essential point is that it is not necessary to convert everyone, just a critical mass. Given enough of a toehold, the better technology can take it from there. The QWERTY problem is but one minor example of a more widespread problem. Our preference for gasoline engines over steam and light water nuclear reactors over gas-cooled is better explained by historical accidents than by the superiority of the adopted technologies. Brian Arthur, an economist at Stanford and one of the developers of the mathematical tools used to study bandwagon effects, tells the story of how we ended up with gasoline-powered cars. In 1890, there were three ways to power automobiles: steam, gasoline, and electricity. And of these, one was patently inferior to the other two: gasoline. A turning point for gasoline was an 1895 horseless carriage competition sponsored by the Chicago Times-Herald. This was won by a gasoline-powered Duryea, one of only two cars to finish out of six starters, and has been cited as the possible inspiration for R. E. Olds to patent in 1896 a gasoline power source, which he subsequently mass-produced in the curved dash Olds. Gasoline thus overcame its slow start. Steam continued to be viable as an automotive power source until 1914, when there was an outbreak of hoof and mouth disease in North America. This led to the withdrawal of horse troughs, which is where steam cars could fill with water. It took the Stanley brothers about 3 years to develop a condenser and boiler system that did not need to be filled every 30 or 40 miles. But by then, it was too late. The steam engine never recovered. While there is little doubt that today's gasoline technology is better than steam, that's not the right comparison. How good would steam have been if it had had the benefit of 75 years of research and development? While we may never know, some engineers believe that steam was the better bet. In the United States, almost all nuclear power is generated by light water reactors. Yet there are reasons to believe that the alternative technologies of heavy water or gas-cooled reactors would have been superior, especially given the same amount of learning and experience. Canada's experience with heavy water reactors allows them to generate power for 25% less cost than light water reactors of equivalent size in the United States. Heavy water reactors can operate without the need to reprocess fuel. Perhaps most important is the safety comparison. Both heavy water and gas-cooled reactors have a significantly lower risk of a meltdown. The former because the high pressure is distributed over many tubes rather than a single core vessel, and the latter because of the much slower temperature rise in the event of coolant loss. The question of how light water reactors came to dominate has been studied by Robin Cowan in a 1987 Stanford University PhD thesis. The first consumer for nuclear power was the U.S. Navy. In 1949, then-Captain Rickover made the pragmatic choice in favor of light water reactors. He had two good reasons. It was the most compact technology at the time, an important consideration for submarines, and it was the furthest advanced, suggesting that it would have the quickest route to implementation. In 1954, the first nuclear-powered submarine, Nautilus, was launched. The results looked positive. At the same time, civilian nuclear power became a high priority. The Soviets had exploded their first nuclear bomb in 1949. In response, Atomic Energy Commissioner T. Murray warned, "Once we become fully conscious of the possibility that energy-poor nations will gravitate towards the USSR if it wins the nuclear power race, it will be quite clear that this race is no Everest-climbing, kudos-providing contest." General Electric and Westinghouse, with their experience producing light water reactors for the nuclear-powered submarines, were the natural choice to develop civilian power stations. Considerations of proven reliability and speed of implementation took precedence over finding the most cost-effective and safe technology. Although light water was first chosen as an interim technology, this gave it enough of a head start down the learning curve that the other options have never had the chance to catch up. The adoption of QWERTY, gasoline engines, and light water reactors are but three demonstrations of how history matters in determining today's technology choices, though the historical reasons may be irrelevant considerations in the present. Typewriter key jamming, hoof and mouth disease, and submarine space constraints are not relevant to today's trade-offs between the competing technologies. The important insight from game theory is to recognize early on the potential for future lock-in. Once one option has enough of a head start, superior technological alternatives may never get the chance to develop. Thus, there is a potentially great payoff in the early stages from spending more time figuring out not only what technology meets today's constraints, but also what options will be the best for the future. Faster than a speeding ticket. Just how fast should you drive? In particular, should you abide by the speed limit? Again, the answer is found by looking at the game where your decision interacts with those of all the other drivers. If nobody is abiding by the law, then you have two reasons to break it too. First, some experts argue that it is actually safer to drive at the same speed as the flow of traffic. On most highways, anyone who tries to drive 55 miles per hour creates a dangerous obstacle that everyone else must go around. Second, when you tag along with the other speeders, your chances of getting caught are almost zero. The police simply cannot pull over more than a small percentage of the speeding cars. As long as you go with the flow of traffic, there is safety in numbers. As more people become law-abiding, both reasons to speed vanish. It becomes more dangerous to speed, since this requires weaving in and out of traffic, and your chances of getting caught increase dramatically. We show this in a chart similar to the one for commuters from Berkeley to San Francisco. The horizontal axis measures the percentage of drivers who abide by the speed limit. The lines A and B show each driver's calculation of his benefit from A, abiding by, and B, breaking the law. Our argument says that if no one else is keeping under the limit, the far left end, neither should you. Line B is higher than line A. If everyone else is law-abiding, the far right end, you should be too. Line A is higher than line B. Once again, there are three equilibria, of which only the extreme ones can arise from the process of social dynamics as drivers adjust to one another's behavior. In the case of the commuters choosing between the Bay Bridge and BART, the dynamics converged on the equilibrium in the middle. Here, the tendency is toward one of the extremes. The difference arises because of the way interactions work. With commuting, either choice becomes less attractive when more of the others follow you, whereas with speeding, additional company makes it more attractive. The general theme of one person's decision affecting the others applies here too. If one driver speeds up, he makes it a little safer for the others to speed. If no one is speeding, no one is willing to be the first to do so and provide this benefit to the others without being rewarded for doing so. But there is a new twist. If everyone is speeding, then no one wants to be the only one to slow down. Can this situation be affected by changing the speed limit? The chart is drawn for a specific speed limit, say 55 miles per hour. Suppose the limit is raised to 65. The value of breaking the limit falls, since beyond a point, higher speeds do become dangerous, and the extra advantage of going 75 instead of 65 is less than the gain of going 65 over 55. Furthermore, above 55 miles an hour, gasoline consumption goes up exponentially with speed. It may be 20% more expensive to drive at 65 than at 55, but it could easily be 40% more expensive to drive at 75 rather than at 65. What can lawmakers learn from this if they want to encourage people to drive at the speed limit? It is not necessary to set the speed limit so high that everyone is happy to obey it. The key is to get a critical mass of drivers obeying the speed limit. Thus, a short phase of extremely strict enforcement and harsh penalties can change the behavior of enough drivers to generate the momentum toward full compliance. The equilibrium moves from one extreme, where everyone speeds, to the other, where everyone complies. With the new equilibrium, the police can cut back on enforcement and the compliance behavior is self-sustaining. More generally, what this suggests is that short but intense enforcement can be significantly more effective than the same total effort applied at a more moderate level for a longer time. A similar logic applies to fuel economy standards. For many years, the vast majority of Americans supported a large increase in the corporate average fuel economy, CAFE, standards. Finally, in 2007, President Bush signed legislation mandating an increase from 27.5 miles per gallon to 35 miles per gallon for cars and similar increases for trucks to be phased in gradually starting in 2011 before taking full effect in 2020. But if most people want higher fuel economy, nothing prevents them from buying a fuel-efficient car. Why is it that folks who want higher fuel standards keep on driving gas-guzzling SUVs? One reason is that people are concerned that fuel-efficient cars are lighter and thus less safe in the event of an accident. Light cars are especially unsafe when hit by a Hummer. folks are more willing to drive a light car when they know that the other cars on the road are light as well. As speeding leads to speeding, the more heavy cars there are out there, the more everyone needs to drive an SUV in order to be safe. Just like people, cars have become 20% heavier over the last two decades. The end result is that we end up with low fuel economy and no one is safer. A move to higher CAFE standards is the coordination device that could help shift enough people from heavy to light cars so that almost everyone would be happier driving a light car. Perhaps even more important than a technological advance is the coordination change that would shift the mix of cars and thereby allow us to improve fuel economy right away. Arguments in favor of collective rather than individual decisions are not the preserve of liberals, left-wingers, and any remaining socialists. The impeccably conservative economist Milton Friedman made the same logical argument about redistribution of wealth in his classic Capitalism and Freedom. I am distressed by the sight of poverty. I am benefited by its alleviation. But I am benefited equally whether I or someone else pays for its alleviation. The benefits of other people's charity therefore partly accrue to me. To put it differently, we might all of us be willing to contribute to the relief of poverty, provided everyone else did. We might not be willing to contribute the same amount without such assurance. In small communities, public pressure can suffice to realize the proviso, even with private charity. In the large impersonal communities that are increasingly coming to dominate our society, it is much more difficult for it to do so. Suppose one accepts, as I do, this line of reasoning as justifying governmental action to relieve poverty. Why did they leave? American cities have few racially integrated neighborhoods. If the proportion of black residents in an area rises above a critical level, it quickly increases further to nearly 100%. If it falls below a critical level, the expected course is for the neighborhood to become all white. Preservation of racial balance requires some ingenious public policies. Is the de facto segregation of most neighborhoods the product of widespread racism? These days, a large majority of urban Americans would regard mixed neighborhoods as desirable. The more likely difficulty is that segregation can result as the equilibrium of a game in which each household chooses where to live, even when they all have a measure of racial tolerance. This idea is due to Thomas Schelling. We shall now outline it and show how it explains the success of the Chicago suburb Oak Park in maintaining an integrated community. Racial tolerance is not a matter of black or white. There are shades of gray. Different people, black or white, have different views about the best racial mix. For example, very few whites insist on a neighborhood that is 99 or even 95% white. Yet most will feel out of place in one that is only 1 or 5% white. The majority would be happy with a mix somewhere in between. We can illustrate the evolution of neighborhood dynamics using a chart similar to the one from the QWERTY story. On the vertical axis is the probability that a new person moving into the neighborhood will be white. This is plotted in relationship to the current racial mix, shown on the horizontal axis. The far right end of the curve shows that once a neighborhood becomes completely segregated, all white, the odds are overwhelming that the next person who moves into the neighborhood will also be white. If the current mix falls to 95% or 90% white, the odds are still very high that the next person to move in will also be white. If the mix changes much further, then there is a sharp drop-off in the probability that the next person to join the community will be white. Finally, as the actual percentage of whites drops to zero, meaning that the neighborhood is now segregated at the other extreme, the probability is very high that the next person to move in will be black. In this situation, the equilibrium will be where the racial mix of the population exactly equals the mix of the new entrants to the community. Only in this event are the dynamics stable. There are three such equilibria. Two at the extremes, where the neighborhood is all white and all black, and one in the middle, where there is a mix. The theory so far does not tell us which of the three equilibria is the most likely. In order to answer this question, we need to examine the forces that move the system toward or away from an equilibrium, that is, the social dynamics of the situation. Social dynamics will always drive the neighborhood to one of the extreme equilibria. Schelling labeled this phenomenon tipping, an idea later popularized by Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point. Let us see why it occurs. Suppose the middle equilibrium has 70% whites and 30% blacks. By chance, let one black family move out and be replaced by a white family. Then, the proportion of whites in this neighborhood becomes slightly above 70%. Looking at the chart, the probability that the next entrant will also be white is then above 70%. The upward pressure is reinforced by the new entrants. Say the racial mix shifts to 75 to 25%. The tipping pressure continues. The chance that a new entrant will be white is above 75%. So the expectation is that the neighborhood will become increasingly segregated. This goes on until the mix of new entrants is the same as the mix in the neighborhood. As drawn, that occurs again only when the neighborhood is all white. If the process had started with one white family moving out and one black family moving in, there would have been a chain reaction in the opposite direction, and the odds are that the neighborhood would have become all black. The problem is that the 70 to 30% mix is not a stable equilibrium. If this mix is somehow disrupted, as it will surely be, there is a tendency to move toward one of the extremes. Sadly, from the extremes, there is no similar tendency to move back toward the middle. Although segregation is the predicted equilibrium, that does not mean that people are better off at this outcome. Everyone might prefer to live in a mixed neighborhood, but they rarely exist and, even when found, tend not to last. Once again, the source of the problem is the effect of one household's action on the others. Starting at a 70 to 30% mix, when one white family replaces a black family, this may make the neighborhood a little less attractive for future blacks to move in. But it is not assessed a fine for this. Perhaps there should be a neighborhood departure tax, analogous to road tolls. But that would be counter to a more basic principle, namely, the freedom to live where one chooses. If society wants to prevent tipping, it must look for some other policy measures. If we cannot fine a departing family for the damage it causes, both to those who remain and those who now might choose not to come, we must take measures that will reduce the incentives for others to follow suit. If one white family leaves, the neighborhood should not become less attractive to another white family. If one black family leaves, the neighborhood should not become less attractive to another black family. Public policy can help prevent the tipping process from gathering momentum. The racially integrated Chicago suburb of Oak Park provides an ingenious example of policies that work. It uses two tools. First, the town banned the use of "for sale" signs in front yards. And secondly, the town offers insurance that guarantees homeowners that they will not lose the value of their house and property because of a change in the racial mix. If by chance two houses on the same street are for sale at the same time, "for sale" signs would spread this news quickly to all neighbors and prospective purchasers. Eliminating such signs makes it possible to conceal the news that would be interpreted as bad. Nobody need know until after a house has been sold that it was even up for sale. The result is that panics are avoided, unless they are justified, in which case they are just delayed. By itself, the first policy is not enough. Homeowners might still worry that they should sell their house while the going is good. If you wait until the neighborhood has tipped, you've waited too long and may find that you've lost most of the value of your home, which is a large part of most people's wealth. Once the town provides insurance, this is no longer an issue. In other words, the insurance removes the economic fear that accelerates tipping. In fact, if the guarantee succeeds in preventing tipping, property values will not fall and the policy will not cost the taxpayers anything. Tipping to an all-black equilibrium has been the more common problem in urban America. But in recent years, gentrification